Coming up today, intelligent slime can learn to dodge icky things, the best camping gear for the Great British summer, and we explain the latest frontier in sports cheating, mechanical doping. You're listening to episode 265 of the Wired UK podcast, your weekly guide to the best of science, tech, ideas, business and design. I'm your host, James Templeton, and joining me are Emily Reynolds.
Hello.
And Matt Burgess.
Hello.
First up, I would like to issue a sincere apology. It turns out it's not a good idea to edit a podcast while eating lunch and trying to send a newsletter.
Oh.
Because you leave mistakes in. So if you heard me introducing Matt Burgess and then going, that was me making a mistake. Sorry, it probably won't happen again.
Don't say that. You can't guarantee that.
It won't happen this week, I promise. We should also mention that tomorrow, April 29th, that's Friday, so maybe the day that you're listening to this, is Wired Health. That's our one-day event that's all about the future of healthcare, scientific research. It's an absolutely amazing event, so you can check out all of the stories from Wired Health on the wired.co.uk website, and there'll also be videos of all the speeches if you haven't made it down to the event, which you can view a week or so after. But if you are there, we look forward to seeing you, and we hope that you have a really, really interesting day. Okay, that's enough housekeeping. A thing you've learnt this week, Emily Reynolds.
I learned that to celebrate its first year on Mars, the Curiosity rover sang happy birthday to itself, which is adorable.
And lonely.
It's sad, but also adorable.
On a planet likely only inhabited by other robots. It beeps it as well.
It's maybe like, they had a party, a tiny little birthday robot birthday party,
but they're like thousands of miles away from each
other. All right,
other.
Stop killing my dream.
It's a sad rover. What did I learn this week? So Facebook's 1.6 billion users click the like button 6 billion times a day. And I guess now they'll be able to do the hate button and the shocked button and the love button.
Sad button.
Yeah. It's just a mind-boggling number.
It's a lot of engagement.
It's a lot of social engagement. Matt Burgess, what did you learn this week?
This week, I have learned how long it took a dog to travel 100 metres on a skateboard. Well, the fastest a dog has ever done this.
This is ridiculous.
Why?
Well, it's an important fact that's really revolutionised my week.
Stop reading the Guinness Book of Records.
Oh, you've given away my
secret. I have given away your secret.
Source.
Okay, so you want us to guess how long it took the world's fastest dog on a skateboard over 100 metres or whatever.
Yeah. And bearing in mind the world record, a human world record for running is around 9 seconds.
Right. Emily?
I'm going to go with double that, so I'm going to go with 18 seconds.
14?
Ooh, Emily's closest, 19.65 seconds.
There
by
we go.
Very
the dog
good.
Was called Jumpy, and it was in California. And a border collie, if that makes any
sense. Is he a professional skateboarder or...?
I think there are videos of this dog on YouTube as well.
So like the canine Tony Hawk.
And actually, while we're on dogs and world records, how long did it take a dog to cycle 30 metres?
Cycle?
Oh, come on, dogs can't cycle.
30 metres?
Yeah, so not very far. The dog was called Norman, if that helps.
That does help. 25 seconds.
35 seconds.
55.
Wow.
Which is pretty good for a cycling
Norman
dog.
Needs to right. up his game.
Yeah, he does. Is he also a border collie?
My sources don't say.
Excellent. Right, okay, next week we can find out. Oh, and we should say that Tim Peake ran the London Marathon in, now what was it, about 3.5 hours?
Yeah, I think 3:25.
Yeah, probably. Which is a really, really good time. And Matt Reynolds went round in just over 4 hours, I think.
Yeah.
And was delighted, but also he's not on the podcast this week, but he said that it was good fun, but very far. So well done to both of them. Matt, staying on athletics, but a slightly dodgy side of athletics, mechanical doping has been making news this week.
Yeah, this week the one of cycling's governing bodies, the Union Cycliste Internationale, has banned Belgian cyclist Femme van der Dijk. That's a terrible pronunciation of her name, but a young female cyclist has been found guilty of technological fraud, and she was caught at an event earlier this year with an electric motor in her bike, and she's been banned for 6 years and fined £14,000.
This is crazy. So, Emily, you were looking into exactly what mechanical doping is and how it's carried out. And there's some fairly ingenious ways of hiding some pretty powerful motors in these bikes.
Yeah, so lots of people hide them kind of in false water bottles, or it's hidden underneath the seat or inside the body of the bike. So, and there are also electromagnetic wheels, which kind of, there's a motor inside the wheels, which are quite hard to detect.
Right. And these sort of systems are activated via Bluetooth, and there'll be a tiny hidden switch on the handlebars, right?
Yep.
It's crazy. And so I think the cycling governing bodies scan bikes to try and detect these kind of things. But there's been some controversy of how effective these scans are and how often they're done. And obviously they're not successful enough because someone got through, although they were eventually caught.
Yeah, so in this particular case, if we cycle back a little bit, the cyclist was caught originally at this event in January with the actual motor and the bike, and that's when it was sort of identified. But this week, the full investigation has been completed by the official body, and they have actually come out with this ruling. And it's believed to be the first time that a cyclist has actually been caught using a technological system to speed themselves up, because that's what this is. This motor is providing a small boost to the cyclist as they go along, which will make a big difference in the sort of competitive area in the race that they're in.
Yeah, and there's also been rumours, completely unproven, unfounded rumours, that other cyclists have been using these techniques and they might not have been caught. But that's just speculation. When you say that it's a small boost, it's actually quite significant. So some motors can provide a 200-watt boost, which gives you an extra 5 kilometres an hour for a set amount of time. And the batteries aren't great, but essentially this allows you to maybe go a bit faster on a hill climb or towards the end of the race when your competitors are tiring, to have an unexpected speed boost, which is provided to you by cheating. And I've said that these mechanical doping techniques are quite hard to find, but how are governing bodies detecting these motors?
Yeah, so this week when the investigation was found out and actually the findings were revealed, the UCI's president said that this was a very big win for the cycling community because they've uncovered this cheating. And to do it, they actually have a number of different techniques that they've tried in the past, and these include X-ray machines, ultrasonic machines to identify the motors that are inside the bikes or the bike shafts. Thermal cameras have been used in some occasions, but on this case they tried out a new method, which was a magnetic resonance testing. And basically the UCI said that this has been extremely effective in locating hidden motors or other forms of technological fraud, as it quickly detects motors, magnetic fields and solid objects concealed in the frame or components.
But as we've seen in the past with non-mechanical doping, there always seems to be ways to get past this, and people will always cheat. But hopefully the methods of detecting it are now strong enough that we won't be writing another story about ingenious, albeit downright cheating, ways of boosting cycling speeds. Elsewhere this week, a new imaging technique has allowed astronomers to view Mars in unprecedented detail and given further evidence to the final resting place of the failed Beagle 2 mission. So this was a British-led mission to Mars to land a rover on the surface. It was meant to arrive, I think, in 2003, but for some unknown reason, the rover never sent a message back. About a year ago, someone spotted it, what they thought was it, for the first time using satellite imagery of Mars, and now we've got this amazing new image of Beagle 2 on the surface of Mars with its solar panels seemingly unfurled. It looks a bit like a flower with its petals out. And it's amazing that we can do this from existing imagery of Mars.
Yeah, so as far as I'm aware, this latest discovery is basically reconfirming that it is definitely there. It's finding out what we actually discovered again last year, that the Beagle 2 did actually make it to Mars, is there on the surface. But how are they actually sort of reconfirm this with the new imaging?
Yeah, so what's interesting about the imaging is it isn't new. It's data that's been around for quite a long time. So there are a number of cameras going around Mars taking photos of it, collecting lots and lots of data. And what researchers have realized is that using a technique that effectively compiles images taken from different angles and even at different times, very different times, years apart, because the surface of Mars changes so little, you can build up high-resolution, more detailed images, which are the equivalent, they say, of some drone photography taken on the surface of Mars. So you're essentially using multiple flybys of the same point at different angles and, I suppose, different trajectories to get a really, really detailed picture of Mars. So whereas Beagle 2 before was just this blurry point of light, it's now still quite blurry, but you can see the shape of the rover. You can see these petal-like solar panels coming out from the side of it. So it's a really good example of just how detailed this imagery is. But it's not just about finding Beagle 2. It's about understanding way more about the surface of Mars without having to send very expensive and, as Beagle 2 proved, potentially ineffective landers to the surface.
And does that mean we're going to use this method in other ways, or are the scientists actually looking to use this in other ways already?
So the European Space Agency, their ExoMars rover, which is due to launch in 2018, between 2018 and 2020, will benefit from the technique. A team at the University College of London will use the technique, which is called SRR, which stands for Super Resolution Restoration, to find suitable landing places for this rover, which is going to drill very deep into the surface of Mars and look for potential signs of life way down below the Martian surface. So to put this into context, cameras currently orbiting Mars have a resolution of about 25 centimeters, but matching these pictures of the same area using the SRR technique brings this down to 5 centimeters. So they're able to see a phenomenal level of detail without having to send any new technology to Mars, which is obviously very expensive. So one of the researchers involved said that this was a new era of planetary exploration, and they're incredibly excited about it and what it's going to allow them to do.
So hopefully we'll see this being used across other data sets that are already existing for maybe other planets, other missions that we've been on, and really expanding what we know about the planets that are already out there.
Yeah, and very briefly, we should say this is related to another discovery this week of a moon. Matt, you wrote about Marky Marky, I think that's how you say it, and that was using existing data. We found another moon very distant in the Kuiper Belt at the edge of the solar system.
So using data from the Hubble Telescope's Wide Field Camera 3, scientists have actually uncovered this new moon and found it hiding behind Marky Marky. It was behind there, and basically looking at the old data, they saw slight fluctuations in the light being emitted, and they actually saw it sort of basically hiding behind the moon.
Yeah, and it was very difficult to spot because Marky Marky appears very bright to Hubble and images captured by it, whereas this very tiny moon barely causes a fluctuation, and we're still not quite sure what orbit it has around Marky Marky.
Yeah, the scientists actually said that, this is a direct quote from them, it actually evaded detection in previous satellite searches due to nearly edge-on orbital configuration, placing it deep within the glare of Marky Marky during a substantial fraction of its orbital period.
Yeah, so they're going to try and study this dwarf planet more to understand what kind of orbit it has. And what kind of orbit it has will tell us how it came to be near Marky Marky. Was it caused by a collision and it was thrown out by that impact? Or was it pulled in by Marky Marky from elsewhere in the Kuiper Belt? And this also means that every dwarf planet, I think, that's been discovered in the Kuiper Belt now has at least one moon. So that's Marky Marky, Sedna, Pluto, and one other that I have forgotten. But really exciting stuff, and proof that there are still really big discoveries to be made even in our own solar system. Emily, a little closer to home, the intelligence of slime.
Yes. So a study released this week suggests that slime mold, which is a single-celled organism and as such has no brain, can actually learn.
Right. But it's not learning as we perhaps define it, but it's been shown to almost make choices based on the world around it.
Yeah, so it's called habituated learning, which is essentially just changing behaviour depending on the stimulus around it.
Yeah, so what did it actually manage to learn?
So it basically managed to avoid unpleasant things. So some slime mold cells grown into a Petri dish and connected to another Petri dish, which is sort of oatmeal, which they think is a really tasty snack, and left to its own devices, it would climb over this bridge to try and get the oatmeal. And normally that takes about 2 hours.
Okay, so this was a bridge made of gelatin, which the slime mold doesn't have any particular problem with.
Yep.
But then?
Then the bridges were contaminated with caffeine, which tasted bitter to the slime, and it started to hesitate.
Right. And then they sort of tried to trick it by putting bits of icky stuff on stuff that it didn't mind and seeing what path it took, right?
Yeah, so then it started moving incredibly, incredibly slowly across the bridge and was kind of learning not to touch the caffeine. And after several days, the time kind of cut down quite a lot. So almost down to the original time, so it had become habituated to the horrible taste.
So this is something without a brain, without a nervous system. It's single cell, but it's able to seemingly learn from its surroundings and act in different ways. So it's really quite a weird way to think about something that's that simple. What else can slime mold do?
But it's actually quite impressive. Previous studies have found it can kind of make its way around mazes. It can choose the best diet for itself. And researchers say that kind of indicates that our understanding of cognitive ability and what that means could actually be extended to organisms without the same kind of nervous systems as we do.
It's crazy.
It is crazy.
And as the researchers explained, it could have quite fundamental implications for our understanding of where intelligence started in the great tree of life from which we all came.
Yeah, so they basically said that the findings are kind of twofold. So firstly, it can help us understand the mechanisms that underlie the learning processes that we kind of understand now, but also, as you said, kind of identify whereabouts in the tree of life the earliest manifestations of learning evolved.
So next time you see some slime mold, I have some in my alleyway outside my kitchen, I will look at it differently and think, you're clever, or pour some coffee on it and see what it does. Or quinine, apparently they don't like that either. Now, earlier this week, Nokia announced it would be buying health and fitness tracking firm Withings for £131 million. But can this deal help Nokia regain some of its former glory? At this point in the show, I'm going to say goodbye to Emily Reynolds.
Bye.
And goodbye to Matt Burgess.
Goodbye.
And say hello to Jeremy White, gear editor of Wired.
Hello there.
So, big news this week. We've all heard of Nokia, but £131 million. Not a lot of people will have heard of Withings, but you've known them for quite some time.
Yeah, Withings have been around for a while, especially in the wearable sector, but also where they've carved their niche is this health technology, and they really did focus that from the start. So they did blood pressure monitors that you know wore at home and got your details to your smart devices. They had wearables like the Pulse OX. They had the Aura sleep system, which was something you slipped under your mattress and it told you how well you slept, and also was some sort of alarm radio that woke you up with a certain lights as well, so you woke very calmly, or whatever. They'd now just brought out a new really cool thermometer that you just stick to your temple, and it uses the light to actually give you a very accurate temporal reading. So they've always been in this health sector, and then most famously, they've obviously went into the smartwatch sector with their Activité watches, the pop steel ones as well.
Yeah, so that's where people will probably know Withings from, is these smartwatches. But unlike the Apple Watch and Samsung's Gear watches, they're not as smart, but they're arguably better watches.
They're better designed. I mean, like watches by themselves are fashion items. You know, the most accurate watch you have on you is your smartphone. Or any really good expensive watch will have far worse timekeeping than that. So the idea to have a watch is purely about style, really. And Withings understood that, and they produced a smartwatch that looked like a nice watch, and it had minimal smart capability. Like, you know, it could analyze your sleep, could analyze how far you walked, but that was pretty much it. But that's what most people use these for anyway.
So it's a Fitbit with a watch face.
That's
almost
right.
Yeah, that kind of thing. So the deal, Nokia said, would start a new chapter for itself as a company, and will create a digital health business within Nokia, headed by Withings CEO Cedric Hutchings. So it seems to suggest that Nokia was maybe more interested in Withings for things like the sleep monitor and the thermometer that they're less well known for, but have carved, as you said, this very good niche for themselves. So does it seem like a good deal based on what you know?
Well, I mean, I think they've overpaid slightly, but what they have got, they've got a load of cash from their maps division, which they sold to a consortium of German car makers. That was nearly $3
billion. Yeah, $2.78 billion last December. It's a crazy amount of money.
Exactly. So they're awash with cash at the moment. They're probably sitting there going, well, what on earth do we do with this? And Withings have positioned themselves incredibly well in this health sector with these, you know, niche devices. And they are a company that's been going since 2008. They've got 200 staff in Paris, Massachusetts, and Hong Kong as well. And they've just been ploughing this fire very well. And what's really good about Nokia buying them is that they've got this whole ecosystem they've already built. So they're just launching. Nokia gets to launch themselves into this you know, smart wearable and health technology sector, or, you know, in one giant leap by just taking this company as a whole. But the thing about that, the Withings, how they've differentiated themselves is that their design is very good. Their industrial design is very good. Their products look really good. Now, everything that we've tested on Wired of their Withings products, one of the problems with Withings products is that they look fantastic, but on the whole, they perform reasonably well too. But they're not as stable as they should be. For example, the watches, the Activité watches, we went through a couple of samples before, and I know other people that reviewed them too, before, you know, you actually get one that actually lasts the distance. You know, their stuff does go wrong occasionally. And likewise, I've used their Withings Home security camera system for quite a long time too. And it's just not as stable as the Nest Dropcam. But the Nest Dropcam doesn't look as nice. So they've got the industrial design right. Their stuff looks fantastic. The apps look lovely too. All very intuitive. It just needs that extra notch of reliability for their product.
Yeah, and sort of sliding as Nokia's fortunes may have over the last few years as it's sold itself, bits of itself off to car companies and to Microsoft, it's always made really, really good products and hires very, very good people. So that combined with the quite unique market that Withings has managed to corner could be quite interesting, especially when you've got the likes of Apple making really, really big plays into health technology and to fitness tracking and health tracking apps. And this is now a really big part of what Apple's trying to do.
Absolutely.
So you can see Nokia's reasoning. And when you have got nearly $3 billion of cash knocking around and however much Microsoft paid for Nokia's devices division, it makes sense to start looking at new markets and new opportunities.
I agree. I think this is a smart move. I think Withings would be bloody delighted with it. I think they positioned themselves for an acquisition. They wanted to be bought, in my opinion. And Nokia, I think, will be very happy as well. They've bought an entire ecosystem in one go. They've got the money to pay for it right at the moment, and they're off and running. So I think everyone's a winner in this situation.
Yeah. And you've spent the last month this was a while ago now, I imagine, with the magazine deadlines, but you've been testing out all of the best gear for the British summer. So camping equipment, outdoor cooking equipment. Sounds like a pretty fun way to spend a few weeks.
It did, yeah, we did. We had an outdoor gear special. I'm not one for the outdoors myself. I like a nice, you know, really plush hotel room given the opportunity. I don't like roughing it. But we decided that we wanted to actually go out and do an extra long gear special in the magazine, looking at all the stuff we could possibly get our hold of. So we even went all the way from the brand new VW camper van right down to the really smallest things you could possibly take with you while you were camping. So we tried to get it. So if you really wanted to go, we had something for everybody in this special.
Yeah, and this is in the security special issue of Wired magazine, which has a cool-looking skull on the front of it. It's on sale now, and I think all of the gear stuff is also online, so you can go and check it out.
That's right.
On wired.co.uk. So let's talk through some of the highlights, and let's start with kayaks. What's the deal with kayaks?
Well, the kayaks we chose, because the problem with kayaks is that, you know, most people see them as strapped to your roof of your car. They're bloody unwieldy things. They're huge. They're expensive. And so we wanted to try out another two options. There's the Uru kayak, which is a foldable kayak, and it comes in an architect's drawing satchel. It's a large sort of plastic satchel that actually folds out into a full kayak that is strong enough to you can take it out in the sea. And another one, which was inflatable. And so we had the two options. We had basically one was inflatable and one was made of this cardboard plastic that you could actually fold out. And we wanted to see whether they're actually any good or not. And we were dreadful, actually, on this lake that we tried them out on. Getting into them was a laugh, you know.
Yeah.
We actually had video that we took of me getting into one of them, the Uru kayak actually, and we couldn't put it on the tablet in the end. It was so embarrassing. I really did. It was really bad.
That's your fault, not the kayaks.
I was screaming like a baby. Honestly, it was very, very bad. You know, there obviously is a technique to get into the water in these things, and I didn't have it. But once you were in, we did me with my fellow tester Chris Haslam, we did a circuit of this lake, which had an island in the middle, and so we actually raced round a couple of times to see how fast these things were and how seaworthy they were. And they were absolutely rock solid. You really couldn't fault them. Particularly with the Uru kayak, it was so slender and sleek in the water that it was incredibly fast. But by far the more stable feeling was the inflatable model, which, you know, you would be, it requires much less brain power to put it together. You just take it out and inflate it. Whereas the foldable one, it had me scratching my head for some time. Actually, I even had to resort to using a go-to YouTube video to see how I was doing. And even then, we put it together and I'd left a vital bit out while I was testing it.
So it's like flat-pack furniture, but it will sink if you get it wrong kind of thing.
It didn't sink. I got it wrong. It didn't sink, but it could have been a lot stiffer, actually, had I put it together properly. But in the shots that we did for the mag, we worked out how to do it right. And so where you see it in the magazine, that's how it should be.
Yeah, and I suppose these are aimed at people maybe a bit like me. I live in quite a small flat. I've got a garden, but I don't have a shed, so I don't really have anywhere to store these sort of things. Whereas if you can shove it under your bed or in your kitchen cupboard or whatever. Even.
That's right, they go really tiny. And obviously, and you can just put them in the boot of your car. They go down really small. So that's the appeal of those things. We also tested a couple of other things as well. That one of the favourite items I had was this a watch by Victorinox called the Inox watch. Now, the Inox watch is their incredibly tough watch. They've actually tested it by driving a tank over it.
This is a ridiculous piece of kit.
Oh, God, it was, you could do all sorts of things with it, but the watch itself is incredibly tough. You can do virtually anything to it. It's a good timepiece as well. We featured it in the magazine before. What was clever about it, though, is they decided to use for the strap, they decided to use this material called paracord. Not something they developed themselves, but, you know, they've, like all good innovators, basically they've decided, they've seen something and they go, that would be really cool if we put it on our product. So the strap is woven, interlaced of paracord, which if you get into trouble in the outdoors, what you're meant to do is undo your strap and cut it so it unravels. And then this strap can be used for, this paracord can be used for tens of different things for the outdoor world. Like, you can, it's very, very handy, obviously, to have very strong, flexible cord with you, tying anything up, tying anything down. But also, when you break it apart, you can use it as when you break the fibers apart and rip it apart, you can use the fibers for fishing line. You can use it to stitch up wounds. You can use it as animal snares.
Floss,
dental floss.
If you want
even.
To floss while roughing it.
Exactly. The number of uses for this thing is fantastic. And obviously, once you've undone it, though, you can't put it back together, even if you don't rip it apart and bit it down to its individual fibres.
But desperate times. It will cost you a lot, but it might save your life.
Exactly. And you could obviously order new straps as well. But
And you'll feel like James Bond while
you
doing
will
it.
Feel like James Bond doing it.
And I think it can support a person's weight as well. So if you were to manage to fashion a zip line, you could fly down on it using your watch strap.
This paracord stuff is brilliant. Check out, all sorts of survival guides online tell you how all sorts of different things you can do with it. But to have it there as part of your watch strap is a very handy outdoor thing.
Yeah, and as well as an inflatable kayak, you also tested an inflatable tent.
Yes, again, space saving, something that you can just shove in the back of the car or in your backpack, actually, and take away with you. But we've all been there. You go camping. You might have stopped off at the pub and then you've actually got to put up a tent. And for those of us who aren't, you know, used to be in the scouts or the guides or anything like that, putting up tents, or especially old fashioned tents, can be quite a bit of a rigmarole. But I think we actually tested out the Heim Planet's inflatable tents. So they had a one man tent, and we also tested out, again, they have a four man, they even have an Expedition 10 man tent as well. But the four-man we put up in less than 5 minutes.
So is it just a case of getting an air pump and away it goes? There's no other assembly?
Yeah, it comes with it. So basically you just get this foot pump, the different kind of pumps actually, but you get this foot pump and on it goes, and the struts on the outside of the tent then fill up with air, really, really rigid, and it goes up in matter of minutes. And then all you got to do is tie the guide ropes down, and there's only a few of them as well. So we went from a backpack with the tent in it to a fully erected tent tied down and staked down into the ground in 5 minutes. And that was a four-man tent. And while we were around, other people in camping area were watching us and sort of marvelling at how quickly this actually went up. It works. It's not the best tent in the world. It is a good tent. It's not the perfect storm of having this amazing tent that's also really quick to put up. But if you're looking for something with considerable convenience and will actually do you proud just for a casual camping. These Heim Planet tents are fantastic.
Yeah, so they're perhaps not suited for the British wintertime, maybe.
No.
They'd be a bit rocky. But in the summertime, if you're maybe doing a few days hiking through the Lake District or something and you just want to pitch up a tent every night,
can
carry it on your back and blow it up each night and deflate it each morning.
Perfect for festivals as well. Absolutely perfect for festivals. For people that only camp, you know, those days when they go away and also don't want a headache when they actually do it. It does take considerably longer to take down than put up. Because you're forcing that air out of all the struts took much longer than you expected.
So you might have to get up before dawn just to to get it deflated in time for breakfast.
That's right.
And one other thing that I know you wanted to talk about is an axe that splits, if you really are a great outdoorsman and you want to be chopping your own firewood, an axe that splits wood as it cuts the wood.
It does. It's from I think Finland. I'm trying to remember here. It's from Finland with a quite a long, difficult to pronounce name. But basically, this guy has designed, I spoke to him actually, this guy has designed this axe where the normal axe heads are, as you know, are wedge shaped and they're straight. And so they go into the wood, they cut very nicely into the wood and they carry on going down. Well, this guy decided that, you know, that's wasting that kinetic energy as you bring the axe down through the wood. Why not make the start of the blade straight and then curved? So as the axe hits the wood, the force you have, the kinetic energy you have bringing the axe down acts as a fulcrum and pushes the wood away, the blade away from the one side of the wood, forcing the log apart. So splitting the wood, I'm not explaining it very well, but splitting the wood as you chop it.
So it's two bits of the job at once.
Two processes at once. It's a really clever idea. And it's one of those ideas you think, why didn't someone think of this sooner? The axe head looks remarkably different to a normal axe head, but it really works. It's a very cool idea. And it's that sort of innovation that we like at Wired, where it's not involving high technology. It's not involving, you know, really, you know, massive technology degrees or anything like that. It's basically a guy coming down and saying, if we just alter this design, this age-old design, we could make it a hell of a lot better. And it works. It's a good idea.
Yeah, and it always leaves you thinking, why did no one think of this before?
Exactly.
It's really clever. And as someone who, most of my camping gear is inherited from my dad, and he bought it when he was similar to my age, so it's now pretty old. I might consider upgrading some of it, especially seeing as the tent probably weighs about as much as me, so I could definitely not put that on my back. Well, thanks very much for talking us through.
No worries. Check it out. There's loads more on the site. You know, we've tested loads and loads of stuff, so have a look at it.
Yeah, I will put the link to all of the gear stuff on the podcast page so people can find it really easily. Jeremy, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we will see you again on the wired.co.uk podcast next week.
Thank you. Bye.